Hey, Mark, why don't you tell us about our brand new sponsor?
All right, Jeff. Funky Soul Coffee is a 70s-themed mobile coffee bar in a specially renovated 1975 Airstream trailer. The owners, Michelle and Gavin, have been renovating the Airstream themselves and are planning to launch later this summer. Their dream is to create a unique coffee shop experience that inspires you to reach for your dreams, too.
Welcome to Idaho History, the show that digs up the most thought-provoking stories from Idaho's history. Here are your hosts, Jeff Wade and Mark Iverson.
That's right. This is Idaho History, the podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Wade, sitting right across from Mr. Mark Iverson, my co-host.
Blue-eyed devil.
What? What's going on, Mark?
Nothing. I'm very curious about this episode because you're like, you don't have to really do much except respond. So
that's right. You don't know what we're talking about. Like, I gave you little hints throughout the last couple weeks, but I doubt you put any of them together.
I think it's the Gallagher.
Oh, the watermelon
guy?
Yeah.
Well, that's what I'm throwing a dart at.
You know, he might have went to try to rescue some POWs in Vietnam. I don't know.
He seems like he'd bring his hammer.
Yep. Smash some melons.
Yeah.
Speaking of melon smashing, Mark, you were doing one of your tours recently, the 1970s true crime van tours, and you stopped at a yard sale. Tell us about that.
Oh, my goodness. It was crazy. And we actually did that. This last tour as well, the guy was throwing out things in the front yard of the Chop Chop House. Ooh. On Linden, I think 805 Linden Avenue, off of Leadville.
Yeah.
And got another peek in the house. People were so happy to be able to like walk around the premises kind of. And the first one several weeks ago, there was an active yard sale there, and I purchased an axe at the house for $1. Now it sits in my van on display, kind of.
Yeah, and this is the house where a man was chopped up after he was murdered. So,
right. I think that was taken into evidence, but perhaps this axe was right next. I don't know.
Maybe.
It's crazy, but yeah, they were chopped up in 13 pieces down there.
So that's an interesting crime that's going to be covered in our upcoming book, Haunted Boise, September 25th. But let's talk about other people that cover crimes. Mark, there's a podcast out there called Ghosts and Garnets, Murder in Idaho. It's two lovely ladies named Whitney and Camden, and they talk about crime in Idaho and other parts of the country now, too.
Yeah, crimes you've kind of looked into, covered. We did the Aryan Nations. They did the Aryan Nations. Whitney came on my tour, and we had a lot of fun together. Great, great laughter on the tour. Yeah.
So check them out. Great show. Mark, where can we give them a listen?
Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere else. I'm sure they've got a good circulation where you get your podcasts. So, and you can check them out on Facebook and Instagram and possibly Reddit. Hell, I don't know.
I don't know if they're on Reddit. If they are, Camden, Whitney, look us up. We'll have some fun on Reddit together.
Right. I believe I asked if she did TikTok or they did TikTok, and I think the answer was no. Oh,
man, it's a dedication. You have to really do that.
I tried, and then I'm like, screw this.
So, Mark, this episode, we're doing a little different tonight, like you mentioned. Like I said, you don't really have to do anything other than fill in some gaps with your brain knowledge like you usually do.
Well, now you said POW rescue in Vietnam, and I'm thinking Rambo First Blood Part 2.
Right you are, sir. Right you are.
Murdoch. You know? At the end. Go ahead.
But yeah, you don't know what I'm telling you about tonight, right?
No.
Like, I kept a pretty good secret, I guess. Mm. And like I said, this is going to dovetail a lot with our episode that we're going to talk about. You know, we just talked about POWs here in Idaho. So it dovetails with that one. And then it's also going to dovetail a lot with your two-parter that you did on the Aryan Nations that we did a few episodes back.
I don't dovetail, buddy. I eagle-tail.
Before I get into this, though, I want to thank a Reddit user named Butter Buttered_spectator, and spectator spelled tater like potato, because, you know, Idaho.
Taters and butter.
So Buttered Spectator suggested this episode. And, you know, I would love for more listener requests. We only have a couple other ones on our list, I believe. So
one was a history of Idaho government development. We'd have to find an angle to that, the beginnings of the government here.
Perhaps. I think there's certain things that we could cover on that might be interesting. But also, while I'm at it, follow us on Reddit, like we said. We're also on Instagram, Facebook, TikTok.
I actually just found a story, well, 2 weeks ago before we get into it, of a stabbing in our legislature in the early 1900s.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, that's something that deserves a little more attention eventually.
Definitely, yeah.
Right.
So, Mark, tonight we're talking about a guy named Bo Greitz. Have you heard that name before?
Oh, my goodness. Mr. Bo Greitz himself. Oh. Not quite Richard Butler, but not quite Bill Wasmuth.
Bill Wasmuth, yeah.
Right.
And he did some wild stuff. Before I get into it, his last name is spelled Gritz, but every article almost you read on the guy, it says rhymes with, and then there's different words like rights or sites or blights.
So Greitz?
Yeah, so Bo Greitz, yeah.
Exercise rights. Greitz is representing his rights, he said, right?
He definitely was all about that.
Okay.
You know, he did some wild stuff here in Idaho, including helping to end the siege at Ruby Ridge and building his own right-winger compound up there in northern Idaho.
Is it still there?
Kind of, maybe.
You'll get to
it. Yeah, we'll get to that. But anyway, folks, buckle up for a wild ride on this one.
All right.
All right.
Let's get gritsy.
So, James Greitz, and I don't know where the nickname Bo comes from. I never found any of that in the research. But, you know, people call him Bo. That's the name he supposedly liked to be called, or still does. He's still alive, so we can't talk about him too badly.
He's still alive.
Still alive and kicking. But he was born in 1939 in Enid, Oklahoma. His parents both served in the military during World War II. His mother piloted ferries, and his father was an Army Air Corps pilot who was killed in combat. Greitz grew up being fascinated by the military, and so he attended a military academy, and then he enlisted when he turned 18. He went to officer candidate school, becoming a captain in 1963, and then went to Special Forces School, where he became a Green Beret.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah. In 1967, he went to Vietnam, where, you know, we talked about there was a little war going on at the time, right?
Not declared, but a war nonetheless.
Well, I think it was declared between North and South Vietnam, right? Or was that
historical about it.
But Greitz became the commander of a detachment of the 5th Special Forces Airborne. And it was during this time where Greitz became basically a war hero, earning a total of 62 citations or medals.
Wow.
This included 3 Silver Stars, 2 Legions of Merit, a Distinguished Flying Cross, Soldier's Medal, 4 Bronze Stars, 2 Purple Hearts, and 26 Air Medals.
And yet Richard Butler has a gravestone with he didn't even go anywhere, right? The Aryan Nations leader.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yep.
That doesn't...
Wait, what?
Oh, he claimed to be in the armed forces, right?
But... Oh, yeah. Right.
Right.
There's a lot of weirdness with these people.
Right.
So Greitz would spend about 6 years in Vietnam, where he would rise to the rank of lieutenant colonel. And one of the most successful Special Forces missions he commanded began in December of 1966, when a U-2 spy plane crashed into the dense jungle. And this was northwest of Saigon, just across the border with Cambodia, where we were also fighting an undeclared war at the time. The black box on that aircraft contained valuable military intelligence and secret codes, and this failed to self-destruct as designed in the airplane. Greitz, who was then a captain, loaded up a combined guerrilla force of 12 Americans and 250 Cambodian mercenaries in some helicopters. They dropped near the border and then had to walk through the jungle along elephant trails for days, avoiding the enemy while possible. And they also engaged in a few firefights along the way. 4 days later, they found the crashed spy plane, and the black box was completely gone, though.
Oh, shit.
The scouts spotted an enemy patrol nearby, so Greitz ordered his force to set up an ambush. His plan was to kill most of the soldiers, but capture two of them for interrogation. And part of the plan was that Greitz and one of his sergeants were supposed to use these billy clubs that were given them to them by the CIA to basically knock out two of the soldiers and carry back, you know, for interrogation. But apparently once this all started, Greitz actually hit his man too hard and killed him. The other guy lived, but resisted the questioning and eventually was shot.
Damn, that's not with the Geneva Convention.
I was just going to say, how did we treat prisoners in the Vietnam War? Fortunately for the mission, though, there was another wounded VC soldiers who had survived the ambush and was captured. Greitz was able to get this one to talk, and he revealed where the camp was, and the black box was supposedly being held in this camp. So Greitz tied some detonating cord around the prisoner's neck.
Jeez.
I think I read that he tied it into a noose, basically, and marched him through the jungle. When they found the camp, Greitz and his troops shot their way in, found the box, and then shot their way out. Dodging a mortar barrage, the men quickly escaped to the extraction zone. Greitz lost none of his men on this mission, and the Air Force, gratefully, would send them $150 to throw a party as a thank you for retrieving this black box.
Well, hey, here you go. That's in 1966 money.
Yep.
What happened to the guy with the necklace?
I think they eventually turned him loose, I hope.
I hope.
So, in his autobiography, General William Westmoreland, who, remember we talked about him at the protest in Boise?
Right. Big wig.
They wanted to basically try him as a war criminal. But in his autobiography, he called Greitz. But Westmoreland called Greitz like basically one of the best soldiers ever to fight in the war.
Right. Regardless of what you're going to tell me after, that's pretty impressive.
Right.
Right.
So after the war, Greitz, you know, he felt pretty lost, like a lot of veterans did at the time. While trying to come to terms with everything he had done and seen in Vietnam, he prepared to end his own life. In 1969, he went up into the mountains of northern Mexico with his pistol and a Gideon Bible that he packed basically as an afterthought. But instead of shooting himself, he decided to read the Bible cover to cover, and from then on, he thought of himself as one of God's warriors.
Well,
so, Mark, this is fun. But soon after this incident, he met his third wife at the time. Her name was Claudia. Mark, why don't you guess how they met?
Jeez Louise. She wasn't VC, was she?
No.
Okay. Was she trying to get across the border or something?
No.
At an Arby's.
Pretty close. This is probably next to the Arby's. They met at a karate class.
Oh, well, shit. Okay, man. Yeah, nice Miyagi-Do.
Yeah, right.
Susan, whatever her name is, the actress with Ralph Macchio.
Yeah. Have you seen
Elizabeth Shue?
Yeah. She was in Cobra Kai, too. Did you see that?
No, I kind of stopped watching that because I'm always frippin' reading about Idaho history.
God, that's all we do. But, you know, it sounds pretty wholesome, you know, karate class, right?
In right.
'60s. Early 70s. But Mark, guess how old she was?
Oh, dude, probably like 10.
She was 16.
And he was?
35.
Oh, yeah, that's creepy.
He forged documents to show that she was about 10 years older than she actually was.
Got his Jerry Lee Lewis thing going on there. Except they were family.
Right, the cousins, Lee. Yeah.
Yeah, that's gross, too.
I was going to say Woody Allen, but that was like his adopted daughter or something like that he married.
Hey, what if you said that to me and I went, right on.
Then we would probably end our business relationship. But he talked about how smitten he was with Claudia, how she was his angel, and I don't know if I want to say this part.
Just go ahead, man.
He would make love to her with his eyes open. And I feel dirty.
Jeez.
Very, very dirty now. Anyway, after that, Greitz was shipped all over the world in completion of his military service. He was stationed in the Middle East for a bit, and then he became the overall commander for the Green Berets in South America. Basically, the U.S. forces, or the U.S. had special forces ready there should it look like any of these nations were about to fall to communism. Special forces would be ready to respond to prevent it from becoming another Vietnam-like situation. Of course, that never happened, but Mark, you know what happened in the country of Guyana while Greitz was in charge there?
Of young girls were wed.
I'm sure, but we talked about this earlier in the car.
Greitz. What?
Jonestown.
Mass shit.
Suicide murder at Jonestown.
Yeah, he did look good in aviators, but other than that,
Jim Jones
was kind of a dick.
So I went down several rabbit holes in this episode, as you can probably already imagine. There's a whole conspiracy about how Jonestown was actually a CIA op, and they landed this CIA medical team who injected all of the victims between the shoulder blades with the poison. And
as they're all drinking Kool-Aid?
Yeah, they just happened to be drinking Kool-Aid at the same time, I guess. Flavor-Aid, actually. It was Flavor-Aid. Don't give Kool-Aid a bad rap.
I thought maybe it was Tang and it was just too sugary. I don't know.
But supposedly the CIA went in and poisoned these people. And then the Green Berets, who would have been commanded by Greitz at the time, went in and shot all the survivors. So,
well, the CIA did poison the democratically elected leader of Katanga in the mid-60s.
It's true.
The Frank Church archives with shellfish extract or poison.
Yeah,
juice, because he was allergic to shellfish.
It's a wild story. They also killed one of the leaders of South Vietnam during the Vietnam War.
So although this is a little crazy, I understand perhaps there's fuel for some of the fire.
And this is why these conspiracy theorists get so crazy about this stuff, because the government has done stuff. So,
right. Yeah.
But Mark, this next part, it reads like a conspiracy, but all this actually happened. So hold on for this. This part's actually rocked my own personal worldview quite a bit reading through this. So, Mark, let's go back to the Vietnam War. And so over the course of that conflict, there were some 1,500 troops who were taken prisoner, U.S. troops that were taken prisoner or went missing in Indochina during this time. You might remember that when Nixon was running for president, he ran on the promise to end the war, right?
Right.
However, the peace talks continuously stalled over, you know, basically these missing men that were still being held captive by the Vietnamese and Cambodians and Laotians, right?
Wasn't like Hanoi Hilton or something like that? John McCain was one of these dudes.
Right, yeah. He was briefly captured by the Vietnamese, yeah.
Yeah.
The Hanoi Hilton's the POW camp. That's right.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I'm like, I knew what you're talking about, but... So these peace talks, basically, the U.S. would demand as part of their platform in these talks that the POWs be released, but the Vietnamese would refuse to do so. So back home in the United States, the MIA, Missing in Action POW problem, became a huge issue. Celebrity fundraisers were held. School children sold metal bracelets with the names of these soldiers.
Chuck Norris made movies.
Exactly.
Oh, that was the 80s.
Yeah, that was later on. Families of the missing implored politicians to do something to help these men. In January of 1972, the MIA POW flag was unveiled. Mark, you know the one, the black background, the silhouette in white of the man. I think there's guard tower and some barbed wire.
Impressive flag, to say the least.
It really is. One of the persons that was really the driving force behind this whole POW MIA movement was a guy named H. Ross Perot. You know that name, right?
Yeah, Ross Perot, man.
He was a multimillionaire. Basically, the OG Bill Gates. I guess he made his money off of computers and then...
I would have said like oil tycoon.
Yeah, his early computers that he made his money off of.
Dana Harvey played him on SNL.
That's honestly why I know who Ross Perot was.
I just remember being like 10 and he was debating Clinton and Bush and just kind of... all around ridiculous.
So he ran for president, I think, twice as a third party candidate in the 90s.
But important nonetheless, and being like, yeah, we need something else here.
And I think, if I remember right, in one of his campaigns, he received the most number of votes a third party candidate ever has. And I don't think he's been top since.
Oh, okay.
Don't quote me on that, though. So, yeah, it was really Ross Perot basically pushing a lot of these fundraisers. And, you know, he was the driving force behind the movement to bring our POWs home. But obviously the war ended without that happening. The nation felt a sadness that so many of its troops were being left behind to languish in the jungle POW camps, probably being forced to labor growing and harvesting crops for, you know, their captors, right?
Being tortured, from what I understand.
Exactly, yeah. The State Department spent a lot of time negotiating for their release, but a growing number of Americans believed that the government wasn't really interested in that. So it was time for private citizens to step up and do something.
Oh, shit.
So, Mark, let's take a quick aside and talk about some of the POWs from Idaho that are still to this day unaccounted for. Mark, why don't you read their names off really quick and the towns where they are from for us?
Okay, John Keith Bodall, Boise, Idaho. Curtis Richard Bolscheid, that's a hard one to say, Pocatello, Idaho. Greg Naaman Hollinger, Paul, Idaho. Halt Hollingsworth, Grace, Idaho. William B. Hunt, Sandpoint, Idaho. William E. Lemons, Pocatello, Idaho. Roderick Lewis Mayer, Lewiston, Idaho, and John M. Sparks, Cary, Idaho.
So that's eight men who are still unaccounted for from the Vietnam War who are from Idaho. I want to just take a second to, you know, honor these men.
Yeah.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that here in a second. But now it's time to reintroduce our war hero, Bo Mother Truckin' Grites.
Bo Grites.
So he started to put together these groups of mercenaries to go into Laos and Vietnam and Cambodia and to basically rescue these POWs.
Just like First Blood Part 2, man.
Exactly. No,
seriously, I mean, like, that's a joke, but also that's the premise of the...
Yeah, so around this time, there's this rumor that started that... Grites was the basis for John Rambo, the character.
Oh, shit.
So basically, he's our real life John Rambo.
Well, but that first movie, he goes ape shit and, you know, he's like, which is a great movie. The first one's a really good movie.
Yeah.
You know, but, and he fights, but doesn't kill.
Right. He doesn't kill anybody in the first movie, right?
Right. He hurts him.
Yeah.
But he doesn't kill anybody. He just wants to be left alone.
But you know what? They drew first blood.
They damn well did.
So I wish I had, you know, more time to go into on some of these raids that he did, because it's like absolute insanity. But, you know, Mark, what do you need to do something like this? You need money, right?
Right.
Where are you gonna get the money? Guess where he got $30,000 for one of these operations.
If you say sea monkeys, I'm going to go crazy, but because Aryan Nations did Sea Monkeys.
It's just as weird. I'm going to give you a hint, Mark.
What?
Man's a celebrity. He's an actor.
Uh-huh.
He has a home in Sun Valley.
Oh, no way.
He filmed a movie in the Treasure Valley.
Clint Eastwood.
Clint Eastwood gave Bo Grites $30,000.
Can you imagine that? Here, Bo. Why don't you go save those boys? All right. But good for him at the same time. I mean, shit.
Perfect. I told you this was crazy, right?
I love it, man.
So, also while preparing for this mission, Greitz sold he sold the film rights to his life story to another famous actor for $10,000.
Oh, man.
Any guesses here, Mark?
Steven Seagal. Oh, Chuck Norris.
Nope. The Shat.
The Shatner?
William Shatner bought his life rights for $10,000. Never did anything with him.
Hey, Bo, what? I can't do a good...
You must go to...
Vietnam.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Something like that.
Yeah.
Boldly go.
Boldly go to where lots of Southeast Asian people live. I don't know. Yeah.
So the plan that Greitz and his team made up of, you know, he had three Americans and 15 Laotians on his team. Plan was that they would go to Thailand, and on November 27th, 1982, they would cross the Mekong River into Laos to find these POW camps that had been identified via satellite or other intelligence. Hmm. Apparently, he had this picture that he had gotten from one of the intelligence services of a place called Fort Apache.
Hmm. Okay.
And the intelligence was that there had been POWs seen inside this camp. But I guess later on it turned out that it was completely empty for all this time. Like during this time, it was just like shadows of trees moving around that had been misinterpreted somehow as POWs.
Yeah, those aerials aren't quite as well as they are now.
Yeah. But meanwhile, back in California, that same day that they were going to cross the Mekong River into Laos, Dirty Harry was to fly to Ronald Reagan's ranch and inform him of what was going on.
Oh, my God. All these very iconic people, man. Ronald Reagan.
So bizarre.
Hey, Nancy. Guess who's coming? It's me, Clint Eastwood.
I've got some news.
I say we say, see what Bo Greitz is up to and send those fuckers to Russia.
Yeah.
Let's have them go after Putin.
You know, he actually trained some Mujahideen fighters later on to fight
the
Soviets.
Mujahideen?
Mujahideen, yeah. In Afghanistan.
Oh, my. And they you know, gave him the, what do they call the, not the, I was going to say bottle rockets. It's still in my mind.
Oh, yeah. The RPG.
That wouldn't have worked.
There's a video of one of these Mujahideen?
Yeah, yeah.
Fighters on his ranch down in Nevada firing a Stinger missile.
Oh, wow. Well, some of those dudes become the Taliban, from what I understand.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, so far, he seems like a pretty cool, crazy, amazing dude.
Except for marrying that 16-year-old, but...
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that part. Right. Oh, yeah, but...
So, Greitz had some high-tech radio equipment that would allow him to communicate with a member of his team back in the States, and he would relay that message to Clint Eastwood. Apparently, Greitz received a message from Bronco Billy stating that if Greitz's team should find evidence of POWs, President Reagan was willing to start World War III to get them back. Oh. Now, whether or not the president ever said this is kind of up for debate, but, you know, kind of adds... story.
Can you imagine Clint Eastwood delivering that if he was like talking to you? Listen here, Bo. We're going to go DEFCON 3. You know? Old Ronnie and me.
Yeah. Well, it's perfect too because they're both actors. So I'm assuming that's how they, because I guess they were good friends.
Yeah, I'm just imagining Ronald Reagan. Clint Eastwood and William Shatner sitting around at Ronnie's ranch with, you know, just talking about this shit. It's amazing. Yeah,
it would be.
Okay.
Be a fly on the wall.
Go ahead.
Sorry. So Greitz and his team cross the border, but they are soon ambushed by an anti-communist militia who was actually supposed to be helping them initially.
Oh, so sorry.
A short firefight ensues, and two of Greitz's Laotian team members are killed, and his American radio operator is taken hostage. So basically, he just created a POW while he was trying to...
But then they have to figure out that they were on the same side, right?
They were double-crossed, basically.
Oh, man.
Yep. So this warlord that took the man prisoner demanded that Greitz pay him $17,000 in exchange for this prisoner. But Kreitz obviously didn't have the money because he just spent it all to get all of his equipment and transportation to his team to get over, you know.
$30,000 sure goes a lot longer way back then.
Right.
Wow.
So they were asking for $17,000. But he, you know, he didn't have the money or he didn't want to pay the ransom. Either way, though, I guess the radio operator was able to escape a few days later. And then Kreitz turned himself in into a police station in Thailand, where he was fined for possessing some illegal radio equipment and then set loose.
Oh, shit.
Didn't find any POWs, POWs, as you can imagine.
I love that. Wow.
Okay. So I think he did like four of these missions in total. And after returning to the United States, he was called before a congressional committee on the POW matter. He presented two bags full of bones, and these were analyzed, and they were found to be mostly animal bones. But there were actually some human bones in there as well, but these bones were analyzed and found to be that of Laotian people.
Okay.
Not American POWs.
You go to a cemetery or something?
I don't know where he found them. I don't think
that's
he ever
strange.
Revealed that.
Okay.
So, Mark, let me tell you this. This is where the POW MIA thing kind of starts to unravel, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, turns out, despite that flag still being flown to this day, thousands or even hundreds of Americans were actually not left behind in Indochina. The whole thing was a myth created by the Nixon administration as a justification for keeping the United States involved in Vietnam.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Where does this source material come from? You might want to throw that out there so people aren't like...
Yeah. So there's actually, if you just Google POW MIA myth, there's a lot of articles in the Times or Time Magazine. There's a great article I'll talk about here in a second called... I think it's called the POW MIA myth. And that was in the Atlantic on December 1st, 1991.
I wonder if that's in the Pentagon papers, you know, like
it possibly could be.
Right. Cause I read that some of those an abridged version for grad school and that was some crazy shit, man.
Yeah. But like there's plenty of sources, like legitimate sources out there. If you want to read
papers.
Up on the, yeah,
okay.
If you want to read up on the POW MIA myth, so in 1976, a congressional committee analyzed thousands of documents and traveled to Indochina. Their report, and this like this is 3 years after the war ended. Keep that in mind. Their report indicated that there was no evidence that any POWs had been left behind. A big problem was the Department of Defense was using terms such as missing in action for any members of the military that didn't show back up at base, either dead or alive. So one of the examples I found of this was where a helicopter with four military personnel took off from a base, got airborne, and then caught fire within eyesight of the base. It was seen crashing nearby, but when rescue crews arrived, every man aboard had been completely incinerated. Or when a jet took off from an aircraft carrier and then immediately crashed into the ocean, in these cases, the bodies weren't recoverable, so they were called missing in action.
Oh, okay.
And it's so weird to me that even though, you know, this has been proven to be a myth, you know, so many people to this day hang on to it. And obviously you were, you know, just like I was, still under the assumption that they were still POWs or.
But there were prisoners of war.
There were.
You said 1,500.
So part of the Paris Accords, which ended the United States' involvement in Vietnam, was that they released all the POWs that were still being held.
Okay.
There was a event called Operation Homecoming where all these men were brought back, and they were actually – they obviously they were questioned when they came home or as part of their release.
Right.
They were questioned. From that, they gained basically intelligence that there were nobody left behind. So – from the actual prisoners of war said that no, all you know, the camps were cleared, everyone came home.
I imagine some people would be like, screw that, I'm pissed right at this, but
you know, this is one of the things that you could probably tell people and they would not ever, you know, you could show them all this evidence, everything
right.
I just told you, and they would not budge on it. So
such, you know, is indoctrination.
What
we're
was
being
I,
lied to.
Yeah.
Nixon did a lot of lying.
Well, that's the thing. The interesting thing to me is that a lot of people who you will see flying the POW MIA flag are the anti-government types that are these conspiracy theory-minded types of people.
And they know it.
Yet they've bought into this lie that started with the Nixon administration.
I was thinking maybe they know it and they're like, oh, this is
No, like these people. Okay, so my dad, right? He was what you call a 3 percenter, which is a
different than the top 1%.
Definitely,
yeah, 1%.
Basically, it was one of the patriot. It is one of the patriot groups, like anti-government type groups. I think he even had a POW MIA tattoo.
Oh, really?
I remember right, but I remember seeing him. I don't remember all of his tattoos, but he had, you know, he would always fly this flag. So all of his friends would too. But yeah, go to the Atlantic article because it's like 22 pages long and it lays all this out and it's very clear. It's from December 1st, 1991, like I said, and it's available on their website, but you have to download the actual PDF, but it's still free to download.
And I bet they cite or at least use primary source material big time. Yeah.
And again, this is 22 years old. So this is like right at the height of when, you know, this myth was propagated and during the time where a lot of these men would have still been alive had they been over there.
Wait, so you're telling me Rambo First Blood Part 2?
Yes.
Isn't accurate?
Yes. I'm sorry.
That was the first rated R movie I ever saw.
Was it really?
In Concrete, Washington, the Red Apple Inn. We're on our way to Montana, and my dad was like, oh, what the hell? Watch it. And I loved every fucking minute of it.
Yeah.
Especially when Rambo is part of the mud cliff, and then he opens his eyes, and he takes down with his famous Rambo knife.
Yep.
Right.
Exactly.
Oh, man.
Such classic.
And then he takes on Murdoch with that whole myth you're talking about.
Yeah.
He's yelling at Murdoch, and he shoots up the whole fort going, you know, shoots the whole fort up.
That's the basis of that movie is going into, was it Vietnam or was it one of the other countries? I think it was Vietnam.
Maybe. It might have just been one of those obscure ones. Like in Rambo 3, it's obviously like Afghanistan,
yeah.
But they don't say it.
Right.
Or like Top Gun. The first one, they don't say it. The second one, too, they don't say it.
No, they don't, yeah. But it's obviously Chinese in the new one, right? And Russian in the...
Well, Russian in the first one.
First one, yeah.
Or second one. Some sort of Middle Eastern country, I believe, in the second one. But anyway, yeah, wow.
So one more thing on that, Mark. When Joe Biden took office, he actually restored the POW MIA flag to its place of honor, flying over the White House.
Huh.
Trump had moved it to the South Lawn. It's the South Lawn of the White House.
Why?
So, I don't know.
That's surprising. You would think it would be the opposite.
The opposite, right, yeah. But I guess Biden is just perpetuating the myth that his old buddy Nixon started. And so, Mark...
I heard Biden. I read an article today that he was kind of a dick.
Oh, Biden?
To his own staff.
Oh, well.
But anyway...
I'm still trying to figure out where that cocaine came from.
Are we talking about Cocaine Bear?
No, the cocaine that was found in the White House.
He replaced the Secret Service with Cocaine Bears.
Yes.
Anyway, sorry.
Go. So, Mark, on that subject, on the POW MIA myth, I would encourage our listeners or anyone who's interested in that to read up for themselves on that because I don't even know if I was able to convince you or any of our listeners of what I just said. So.
Oh, no, I believe it.
So,
because I read the Pentagon Papers and Nixon was I mean, it was like after Eisenhower, it all went to like secret ops and craziness.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know about Ford. Nobody seems to consider Ford, but.
Did I tell you, I found out the other day that my father-in-law had had met Ford in the White House.
Did you say he was a Chevy guy?
Yeah. Anyway, sorry, let's get on with this.
Okay, sorry.
But yeah, definitely read up for yourself. Like it's like I said, it blew my worldview apart.
Dude, I totally believe it because I went through the Frank Church Committee on CIA Operations and Overreaching, you know, Crimes. Man. Holy crap, dude.
Yeah.
And this is verified shit. Anyway, go ahead.
So, yeah, not only was there First Blood Part 2, so the 70s and the 80s, that really, there are several Hollywood movies that portrayed these missions into the jungle to rescue POWs,
right? I know where you're going.
The Deer Hunter.
Okay. Sorry, but I was just thinking the Deer Hunter. What's his butt later wasn't a POW. Right. Christopher Walken stayed there after being a POW or somehow got out. And then he's doing the famous scene where he's playing Russian roulette.
Right. Such a long time since I've seen
that movie. But yeah, the Deer Hunter. Okay.
That's where he got the watch that he had to smuggle back.
No, that's Pulp Fiction. Yeah. Right.
But it's Christopher Walken. He has a whole scene where he talks about smuggling the watch in his ass. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Just,
And then there's Gene Hackman's Uncommon Valor. Okay. And then you mentioned Chuck Norris, and Missing in Action was his movie that he made.
Flight of the Concorde.
Yeah, there were several others at this time.
About Delta Force with Lee Marvin? Was that one of them?
I don't know.
It's like Lee Marvin's like, it's like Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. It's like this fucking 88-year-old guy just screwing, kicking the shit out of me.
Yeah.
All right, anyway.
But obviously, these movies were based in part on Bo Greitz and his missions to go into these countries and try to rescue these.
Well, then what the hell was he trying to rescue? He didn't know.
Well, that's the thing. I don't know if he was completely hoodwinked by this, or if he was in on it, if he was part of it. I don't, like, that's the thing that kind of blows my mind, and I'm like, what the heck was going on?
Huh.
But I sincerely believe that he sincerely believed that these men were there.
Yeah, you wouldn't try to go all the way over to Indochina four times.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And getting firefights with rebels and shit.
Right.
But these movies, obviously, they serve to perpetuate that whole mythology of
my freaking childhood.
Yeah, right.
Right. And then there's obviously the Arnold movies. I'm pretty sure a large hunter alien didn't come down to the Amazon or wherever the fuck it was and try to.
Was Commando, was that one of the?
Oh, I don't think it was one of his movies, but I don't think that was.
I can't remember that one either. Anyway, let's get on with this. Mark, I promise we're going to get to Idaho soon. Don't worry.
Okay.
So the next couple of decades, they start to get even weirder. He became interested in running for president, and so he joined the Populist Party. Do you know anything about the Populist Party?
I do know, like, Huey Long in Louisiana was a populist, a famous populist. Trying to think of other ones, but...
David Duke.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's still around, unfortunately, like a... pimple on your nutsack.
So in 1988, Greitz was put on the ticket as a vice presidential candidate, supposedly without knowing who the presidential candidate would be, which turned out to be David Duke. He was the former leader of the KKK. Greitz apparently found out about this, and he resigned his nomination 2 days later.
All right.
Duke would go on to earn about 0.5% of the national vote that year. 4 years later, though, when Greitz was on the ballot for president, he was able to double that at 1% of the popular vote.
Oh, wow. Bo knows.
Yeah.
I remember Bo Jackson. That's a different Bo.
So I had heard actually during his 1992 campaign that Greitz initially supported gay rights.
No shit.
But I couldn't find his actual, like, position on what he, you know, wanted to do with that. However, later on, he would go hard against gay rights, as we'll see.
He'd go hard against it?
Yes. oh, you're gonna like his campaign slogan. Guns, God... and Greitz. What's his campaign?
Oh my God, there's no ego involved in that.
Not at all.
Oh my goodness.
So here in Idaho, he actually, during the 1992 presidential campaign, he received about 10,000 votes. So yeah, that's support base here in the Jim State. That same year, 1992, would be the year that Greitz really made some headlines here in Idaho. You know what happened in August of 1992, right?
Ruby.
Ruby Tuesday.
Ruby Tuesday.
So Greitz received a call from the FBI asking for some help. A man named Randy Weaver and his family were holed up in their home up in Boundary County, a place called Ruby Ridge. So by this time, the standoff had been going on for about a year or over a year, and he had so many opportunities to turn himself in. But that's another episode. We talked about doing a Ruby Ridge episode, Mark, and I think you have a someone that you were going to invite on to help us out with that, right?
He is a member of the faculty at Boise State University, and in fact, a good friend of mine. We're going to ask Tim Gill.
Yeah.
But he is an expert in conspiracy theories, anti-government sorts.
So you should hit him up before this airs to make sure he's on board with that.
Oh, he already said he is.
Okay, good. So, Tim, look forward to having you on.
And he's going to help lead some of the macabre tours because he's that great. Anyway.
Yeah. All right. I can't wait for that.
Yeah.
So on August 21st, two U.S. Marshals accidentally ran into Weaver's 14-year-old son, his dog, and a family friend named Kevin Harris. A firefight began, and that left the dog, the teenager, and one of the federal agents dead. A government sniper also shot Randy in the shoulder and killed his wife, Vicky, while holding their 10-month-old baby.
You should not have taken that shot.
Yeah, definitely a tragedy all around. Yeah, let's save that one for the Ruby Ridge episode that's hopefully coming up. But Greitz, in an interview in 2020, said that he was asked to help because the Weavers were white supremacists. He took that as the FBI was inferring that he was also a white supremacist, which apparently was news to Bo Greitz.
Okay.
The Weavers also didn't really consider themselves white supremacists either, but they were part of the Christian Identity Movement. Mark, can you school us a little bit on what that was? Is, I guess. Hasn't gone away.
Well, part of the Christian Identity Movement, of what I remember, is that the Aryans were, in fact, the chosen people and not... They were, as I would say, the true Jews.
Yeah. The Christians were the true Jews. They put Christianity ahead of their identity as white people.
And it was tied to historical roots of supposed Aryan light-skinned conquerors of what is now like Iran and Syria and parts of Egypt and places, Israel.
India.
In parts of India. Yeah.
We talked more about that at length in your Aryan Nations episode.
Right.
So when Greitz arrived at Ruby Ridge, he was greeted by a crowd of all sorts of racists, basically, right?
But here's the thing, but Randy Weaver, and being a follower of the Christian Identity, was a racist for sure.
Yeah, maybe I misspoke. They definitely are.
They were on the mailing list for the Aryan Nations, but they weren't, like, from what I understand, active.
Yeah, Randy had been to a couple of the congresses, I believe, right?
Right.
At the Hayden Lake compound.
I tried to play Dungeons and Dragons once, several times, but does that make me a Dungeons and Dragons?
Makes you a nerd, yeah.
Well. I didn't tell my friends about that one.
Okay, good.
Anyway, go ahead. I like D&D.
Yeah, I mean, it would take some time to explain the differences between Christian Identity and the Aryan Nations. Basically, they're all a bunch of racists and, yeah.
Okay, anyway, sorry. I just wanted to make that point.
Yeah. Okay. No, you're right. Definitely. But, yeah, so Greitz, you know, he pulls up to Ruby Ridge, and down below where the actual cabin was, there was, like, a roadblock.
Right.
And they had protests and counter-protests going on there. Greitz, when he arrived, he was kind of seen as like this hero, this guy, this man who's going to go in and save the day to a lot of these people, even though like he didn't really subscribe to the Aryan Nations ideologies or anything like that. He was still seen as this really ultra right-wing leader at the time. So that's why he was called in to help with this. He was led through the crowd to the U.S. Marshal's command center, where telephone communications had been established with Randy Weaver. Greitz got on the phone, talked to Randy for a little bit, but when talks weren't going so well, Greitz decided to do it in person, despite the wishes of the federal agents. So Greitz walked up to the cabinet, to the cabin, called out to Randy, and then after confirming that it was in fact Beau Greitz, Randy let him in to the cabin, and after another day or two of talking, Greitz escorted Weaver out of the cabin and into the custody of the waiting marshals.
At this point, how was Harris and Weaver? How many people were in there now?
So I believe it was Weaver, Harris, and then the baby. So three people.
Okay.
There might have been another child. I can't remember. It's been a while since I've really studied hard. His successful negotiations at Ruby Ridge really made him a hero among the right-wing crowd.
Right.
Greitz briefly considered running for governor of Idaho, but since he had lived in, he was living in Arizona at the time, he, according to him, he would be seen as a carpetbagger. So he shifted his attention and focus to developing products and instructional videos for survivalists. He called this program Specially Prepared Individuals for Key Events, or SPIKE.
Okay.
Yeah. And he really, he started to stoke the fears of the impending Y2K disaster to sell these products. Mark, you remember Y2K, right?
Oh, yeah, man. I was actually kind of freaked out. I was partying at this one house. I remember I was freaked out.
It was scary, mainstream scary. It wasn't just, the conspiracy theorists. Mm-hmm. It was in the news.
When it hit, we were all
yeah.
What's going to happen?
Yeah, I was at my friend Tony's house, and we were, we had been watching all these, apocalyptic kind of movies, Armageddon and, all those movies that had come out in the late 90s anyway. Hmm. It was also during this time that he really became vocal about the issues that people like Jews, homosexuals, and feminists were causing in society. You can't see my eye roll here. But the biggest thing he seemed to be concerned with was the coming of the New World Order, which was supposed to be...
Hulk Hogan?
No. this one's less... This one's supposedly led by the Jews that were going to... Jewish elite that's going to take over the world. Actually, there's a lot of people that still believe in this, that this is going to happen. It's weird shit.
I forget there was another name for him. Sog?
Oh, the Zionist occupied government.
Yeah. Okay.
And that was a big thing that Randy Weaver preached as well, is that the Zog was coming for him.
Yeah, he had that on his shirt when he talked to Alex Jones.
That's right, yeah.
What a dick. Anyway.
So, getting to Idaho, in an effort to create a place for him and his followers to ride out this coming Armageddon, Greitz established a commune near Kamiah, Idaho, which he called Almost Heaven. Have you heard of this, Mark?
No, I was thinking it was in Athol, and I thought that was fitting, but...
yeah. Well, okay, so he established several different communities, so there might have been... Because it's the same area, though, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Greitz and some of his financial partners purchased, and I saw different numbers, anywhere from 650 to 1,200 acres or lots on the plateau overlooking the Clearwater River, and which they divided up into lots. The only requirement to purchase these lots was to basically everyone had to agree to defend their neighbors should anyone's constitutional rights become threatened.
Okay. I'd hate to be a closeted homosexual in that group.
Right. So it's called a covenant community because that was the covenant that you would sign to, I guess, kind of like CCNRs, but.
Okay.
You hate Jews? I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, right. You have to. Yeah, anyway. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
You can tell, you're signing up to defend your neighbor's constitutional rights should they be infringed. So, obviously, people are looking at this situation after Ruby Ridge and after Waco and be like, what the hell's going on here, right?
Right, he's doing the same shit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, since Greitz was already a celebrity, media outlets across the country picked up the story of Almost Heaven, which attracted all sorts of right-wing types from all over the country. All of the lots in the new community soon filled up, and similar communities with names like Shenandoah, Doves of the Valley, and Woodland Acres were formed. More extremists settled around Grangeville during this time. Some of the residents of the new community included, according to newspaper reporting from the time, and I think this comes from Gretz himself, there was a former bank president, an L.A. attorney.
Randy Quaid.
So there's that movie that he did about Ruby Ridge. Have you seen that?
Randy Quaid's?
Yeah.
No.
It's on YouTube. We need to watch it before we do that episode.
Okay.
I wouldn't be surprised, though. But he also said that a lady named Esther Ruth Jenner, who was the mother of, at the time, Bruce, but now Caitlyn Jenner, lived in one of these communities.
That's wacky.
It is wacky. So I went down this whole rabbit hole.
Esther's a Jewish name, too, isn't it?
Really? I don't know if the Jenners are Jewish.
Well, okay.
Maybe.
No, but Esther, okay, anyway.
It's a biblical name for sure. But
yeah.
I kind of went down this whole rabbit hole on Caitlyn Jenner. Apparently, when the Fred Meyer here in Nampa and the one down in Garden City were opened, Jenner actually came to these stores. It was like 1973 or 75 or something like that. Helped open the stores, the Fred Meyer stores here in the Valley. So that's kind of interesting.
That's random.
Right? Wow. Made a big deal about Idaho potatoes.
There's lots of random stuff in this episode, man.
This is so random. Like I said, rabbit holes upon rabbit holes.
Buckle up, buckaroo.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's a South Park. Anyway, go ahead.
And I should add that I don't know if Esther Jenner actually had lived in one of these Covenant communities or if she lived nearby. I know for sure she died in Lewiston, actually, just this year. I think back in February this year, she died in Lewiston. So she certainly lived in Idaho. I also found a story listing her address in Kamiai. So maybe she did or was in the area. I don't know anything about her politics or her beliefs or anything like that, though.
We should include her in a cemetery book if she...
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Definitely. But local residents at first tried to peacefully coexist with their neighbors. These people, you know, they come from logging, mining, farming backgrounds. They knew the value of hard work and they wanted to be left alone to do it. They assumed that the newcomers were also coming to the area just to do their own thing and to be left alone. But then there started to be issues. Some of the almost heaveners went down to the, I think, Clearwater County. Is that Grangeville?
I think so. I don't know.
Anyway, they went down to the county courthouse and filed paperwork to renounce their citizenships of the United States. Oh. So these are people who we would call sovereign citizens, right? Have you done much study on these people?
I know there's like a movement for parts of California to become...
So right. this is a little different. Sovereign citizens are, they don't believe that the laws of the United States apply to them for various reasons. For example,
Okay.
They believe like they don't need driver's licenses because they're not driving. They're traveling when they are driving a car.
Well, if they drive off their land, then they sure as shit need a driver's license to go through America.
Yeah, they do. And then, like, another example I see a lot is, like, if they go to court and there's fringe on the American flag, they'll say that that court doesn't have jurisdiction because that's an admiralty flag, and admiralty means naval law or something like that. Anyway, they're huge, huge threat to law enforcement because they have acted violently toward... There's a video, I can't remember what state it was from, but there's these two sovereign citizens that got pulled over by the police, and the son is father and son. I think the father was driving. The son leans out the window with an AK-47 and shoots the cops. And then they end up getting into a firefight in the Walmart parking lot, and they get killed.
The cops got killed?
A couple of police officers did get killed, but they ended up killing the...
Where was this?
I can't remember what state. It's a wild video, though.
Yeah, not really, just Idaho.
It's not just Idaho. It's all over the United States, unfortunately. Some members of the Almost Heaven community also formed a militia called the Idaho Mountain Boys. And they actually threatened to kill the federal judge who presided over Randy Weaver's case.
Sounds like a fucking jug band.
I was thinking, what's the Soggy Bottom Boys?
Soggy Bottom Boys. Hey. Yeah.
But these militia members were often seen with guns walking around Kamiai, and one of its residents was actually arrested and sent to prison for bomb making after he planted landmines around a friend's foreclosed property in Almost Heaven. Jeez. So definitely not good neighbors. Nearly everyone at Almost Heaven seemed to see the same handwriting on the wall. Greitz and his followers subscribed to a conspiracy theory commonly believed in right-wing extremist circles. Federal authorities plan to disarm Americans, according to this theory, to clear the way for an international invasion force called, the New World Order, I mentioned before.
Black Panthers would believe that because they were disarmed.
Yeah.
Anyway, they were throwing bombs here.
Yeah. But they think that, or they thought, think, still think, that this New World Order will be manned by United Nations soldiers and financed by an international cabal of Jewish bankers. So the theory goes.
The Koch brothers.
Yeah. The Rockefellers. What's the other one?
I was just joking about the Koch brothers. Are they?
They're not. I think that's one of the names I've heard thrown around. Basically, these ultra-rich families, people.
Yeah. Well, they might be right, but, not tied to Judaism. they're just rich people.
Yeah.
Right.
It's critical, Greitz told the residents of Almost Heaven, to resist government attempts at gun control. So, they were voting against gun control, ready to die, fight and die to fight against gun control.
As Charlton Heston would say, out of my cold, dead hand.
Exactly.
And he is holding up a musket. I don't mind if you have a musket, Charlton.
Right.
Or a gun or whatever, just maybe.
Just don't shoot me.
Not a 30 caliber machine gun. No.
Or something. Why not?
But whatever. Yeah.
But the residents of Clearwater County, much like the people of Kootenai County, fought back against the invasion of the right-wingers by forming an organization called the Clearwater County Citizens for Human Rights. This group worked with business owners to put up no gun signs, wrote letters to lawmakers, and encouraged police to arrest the troublemakers.
See, that's the thing that's not focused on in Idaho. I didn't know about that, but you had all these human rights coalitions and coalitions against this kind of stuff pop up in Idaho, right?
No, we just get labeled as racist and, even though it's the people of Idaho fighting back against these people that are coming in.
I've heard that Wisconsin has a lot of people, too, that are far-right kind of anti-government sorts and great cheese. We got potatoes and so. I mean, it's... Yeah. Right? Anyway.
Same shit, different state.
Right.
So, Father Bill Wasmuth, who we talked about at length in our Aryan Nations episodes,
Bill.
Was frequently contacted by the media to offer quotes about Bo Greitz and Almost Heaven. Now, Wasmuth, like a lot of people, were afraid that Almost Heaven would turn violent.
Gripe with Greitz.
Great, yeah. Here's one of his quotes that he said. He said, quote, "A few of his followers are a lit fuse away from violence. There's just too many trigger points for that not to happen, and Wasmuth felt that it was eventually going to turn into another Ruby Ridge or Waco." Right?
Yeah.
So according to Greitz, part of the reason he chose the land that he did to build Almost Heaven was to deter the government from coming there. It was too spread out, he said, and it would take an entire army to do any damage. Mark, did you watch that that television show I sent you from the 90s?
Yes.
I'll take that as a no. So... there's this show on BBC called Louis Theroux's Weird Weekend.
Oh, yeah. I watched like 3 minutes of it.
Did you?
I totally forgot about it.
So the episode itself is called Survivalists, and you can find it on Daily Motion. So this guy from the BBC, the British Broadcasting Channel, comes to Idaho, and he's going to these different survivalist places. He starts at Almost Heaven, talks to Bo Greitz, and Greitz, he actually has this map that he has rolled out on his coffee table. And while he's talking to Louis, he has a marker in his hand. And he's going throughout the entire United States, and he's, marking off places that aren't safe. So Florida has hurricanes, can't go there. California has earthquakes, can't go there. North Dakota has nuclear missile silos, can't go there. And so he's going through and in the entire, and it actually looks like a penis that he drew for the missile.
That's fitting.
It was funny. But he gets done and the whole map is marked out. And then he's like, except for this little area, and he circles it, and it's where Almost Heaven is. He's
it has forest fires.
Right. Yeah. forest fires, some bad winters occasionally, you know, stuff
Blizzards,
like that.
Yeah, sure.
But basically, he's like, this is the safest place in America.
It has white supremacists.
So, Louis Theroux, the host, he goes on. So he talks to Gryce for a bit, and then he goes and he's actually asking Gryce about some of the other people who have settled there. And Gryce, he calls. He's talking about these other people who live there and how they're too extreme for his taste. And he calls them noodles. And I'm not sure exactly what he means by noodles.
Too extreme for him.
You're too extreme for Bo Gryce. Yeah. Uh-huh. These are the people who are, you know, I think, because Gryce, honestly, as crazy as he sounds with some of the stuff, he was actually seemed pretty level headed throughout most of this. He had his beliefs. He did what he did, but I don't think he was ever ready to go into open war against the United States government. But there were people in Almost Heaven that were ready for this, right? So he's like telling Louis Theroux about these people. And he's like, Louis asks him, he's like, what would happen if I were to go talk to these people? And Gryce says, oh, basically they would point their guns at you and it probably wouldn't end well. And so he's like, okay, where can I find him? And he goes and he finds these people, right? Whoa. And it actually turns out very good. You'll have to watch this, Mark. It's very entertaining.
I was going to watch it, and then life happens with the life. Van and all that kind of stuff.
You had to replace that alternator.
Oh, yeah. Jeez, that was fun.
So anyway, I won't give you the whole episode, but after that, he goes up to the Aryan Nations compound, and he's riding in the car with Butler, and then what was his like number two guy's name?
Door or something.
Toward the end, of course, because it's 1998.
One of the guys that bombed stuff.
Yeah,
I think the guy you're talking about.
Maybe it was him. Anyway,
their security head.
So they drive him into the compound. They go up into the. They have their chapel there. They go up into the bell tower.
Yep.
But then at the end, he's talking to Richard Butler, and he asks Butler about Bo Gryce, and so. So Richard the Dick Butler says, I believe in the survival and perpetuation of my race. I think he is more or less a multiculturalist, which is like a bad thing to him, I guess.
Okay.
He married an Asian woman and has Asian children. He let a Mexican family or a Filipino family in there. He's not really pro-white.
Okay.
I realized writing this episode that there's like a spectrum of these alt-right groups, right?
Right.
So,
I mean, he, in believing in Christian identity, right? Bo Gryce did, or was that Randy Weaver?
Those both of them, yeah.
I mean, he's saying that he thinks the Aryans are the true Jewish people, but I guess you could see that he would incorporate other people because he didn't necessarily say like, I hate other groups. I'm just saying we're the chosen folks.
And his wife was Asian. So, I mean, he's not like full-blown white supremacist. His gripe was more with Jewish people, I guess.
So he's anti-Semitic.
Yes, that's the term. Thank you, Mark.
But he, like, I wonder where he... Because part of the Zog thing was that, you know, black people and Hispanic people, Latino people, were dupes of the Jewish... cabal or whatever.
Yeah.
So I don't. Anyway, I see your point though.
Really, to me, highlights the loose nature of these ultra right movements. Fortunately for the rest of the United States, they can never really get together on their beliefs, so they tend to stay somewhat separate. I mean, there's some intermixing between the two groups. You know, we had that Unite the Right rally about 5-6 years ago where one person died. After a car was driven into the crowd, right?
Oh, in Charlottesville.
Charlottesville, yeah.
Right.
But even after that incident, like the right-wing groups don't really seem cohesive at all, right?
Well, you know, even at that event or like in North Idaho, you have, you know, like the Aryans in many ways were right-wing. But as we see, they were trying to form a multi-racist white supremacist group that had all sorts of different beliefs, but not Bo.
Yeah.
But his people.
Yeah.
But it was the same thing at the Unite the Right. There were all these different groups, sometimes at odds, but there was one main right goal or whatever.
Yeah. So here's another incident that illustrates Greitz's dislike for other extremist groups. In 1994, Greitz was called again by the FBI to help with a standoff in Montana. A group calling themselves the Montana Freemen were holed up on a ranch that was being foreclosed on. The group was heavily armed and threatening violence. The FBI, freshly out of the incidents at Waco and Ruby Ridge, had every desire to end this one peacefully. So they call up old Bo, who went to Montana with his new friend, Randy Weaver.
Oh.
When they arrived, the FBI wouldn't allow Randy to go into the Freeman compound, but Bo did go in. He sat down with the Freeman about 5 times in 4 days, trying to get them to give up peacefully. Unfortunately, these men were mostly the sovereign citizen types, and Greitz gave up, stating that the Freeman had just given him a mixture of religious and legal mumbo-jumbo. After 81 days, they finally actually did surrender peacefully, though.
Oh, good.
Again, in 1998, Greitz thought he could help the government, which is kind of weird that he's kind of anti-government yet is willing to help.
Well, he's probably helping the people that he sees himself helping, the people that are standing up to the government.
Yeah, exactly. You remember the bombing at the Atlanta Olympic Games in 1998.
Right. Okay.
Eric Rudolph was the man who set off 4 bombs in Atlanta and Birmingham, 2 of which were at those Olympic Games. He killed 2 people and injured several more. Greitz went into the Georgia mountains to help search for Rudolph, but came up empty. And Rudolph, you know, he would eventually be captured by law enforcement and pled guilty to those bombings. But just a few days after returning to Idaho after searching for Eric Rudolph, Bo Greitz was found with a bullet wound in his chest next to a gravel road on the outskirts of Orofino, Idaho, about 25 miles from Almost Heaven. He's lying next to his pickup truck, and a .45 caliber pistol was found next to him. When he returned home from looking for Rudolph, he was met by his wife Claudia, who had divorce papers in hand. In an act of desperation,
it's a bad evening, too.
Yeah. So he drove out of town, lay down next to the road, and shot himself in the chest.
Oh.
But this man, he supposedly killed 400 people, but he failed to take his own life, and he was able to recover.
Where did he shoot himself in the chest? Like the upper chest or something?
Yeah, they said he just missed his heart by an inch or so.
Oh, wow.
But the divorce did go through, and he eventually married his 4th wife a little while later. But, you know, not everything was hunky-dory in Almost Heaven. I should mention that Greitz had also been arrested several times in the 90s, once for interfering with, situations that he wasn't really involved in. There was a child custody dispute in Connecticut that there was, like, some allegations of satanic ritual abuse going on. So he went and actually took the kids out of the school, and he was arrested for that one for kidnapping. There was another incident back in the 80s where he was arrested for using a false passport, and that was part of the whole POW rescue missions. That charge was dropped. Probably the most famous case that he involved himself in was the Terri Schiavo case. Remember back in 2005,
wanted to end her life.
She was on a feeding tube,
right? Or they wanted to end her life.
Yeah. Okay. So he went to Florida carrying a quote citizen's arrest warrant for everyone who aided and abetted the removal of Terri's feeding tube, including Governor Jeb Bush and the state's attorney general.
My goodness, this guy is nuts.
Yeah. So, one of the biggest draws of Almost Heaven was that it was built to withstand the social and technological disturbance of the Y2K disaster. However, Greitz counted down the last couple of months of the last millennium in Nevada, basically abandoning Almost Heaven after his suicide attempt. By 2004, the excitement around the community had pretty much died down. From his home down in Nevada, Greitz said, quote, "If push ever comes to shove, I'd take my dog and my wife and go back. I still think it's the safest place on Earth." I assume some of Greitz's former followers probably still live up there, but the last substantial news story about the community was in 2004. Greitz, like we said, is still alive, and the last news story about him said that he was living in Nevada, still hosting a radio show Although I couldn't find his website is no longer active. I couldn't find his radio show. He's got
to be pretty old at this point.
He's in his 80s, so. His Spike website is still up if you need some help prepping to fight against the New World Order there, Mark. So one last thing about Greitz is a lot of people believe that he was a bit of a huckster, obviously. He definitely took advantage of a lot of people's fears of Y2K and the NWO to sell his survival courses and lots up in almost heaven. But remember how he's supposed to have been the basis for Rambo. That actually there was a book that was the character John Rambo came out of.
Did he base that on Greitz? Ritz?
I think that actually happened before a lot of Greitz's celebrity started coming out. So okay. It's kind of murky on whether maybe partially it was based on Greitz.
But Rambo was in the right in the first movie.
He was, honestly. Yeah, he was.
Right.
But let's really quick talk about those 62 citations that he supposedly earned in Vietnam.
No.
Yeah. So a lot of those were... Okay. This is all allegedly. None of this has been proven, but okay. Allegedly a lot of these citations were actually based. So he was the commander of the unit he was in. These citations were usually based on the reports that the commanders of the units would write in their after action reports.
Oh my goodness.
So a lot of it is thought to have been from his own reporting about why he earned a lot of these medals.
That seems like way more than I've ever heard people get.
62. Right? So that was more than General Westmoreland earned in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam combined.
Right. And I was thinking of Ken Hastings, you know, the number that he got is the most decorated soldier, one of them,
yeah,
of World War II. Like, that's way bigger than that,
right? In Vietnam, you know. So the 24 air medals is actually one of the points of contention. So to gain an air medal, you have to have a certain amount of flight time. So being in a helicopter, being dropped behind, you know, doing an air mission like that. I saw one, and I was reading through like forums, so I don't know if this is true or not, but they basically figured out that he would have had to have been in continuous combat for, I think it was like 575 days, to earn 24 air medals. And I think the most, or I can't remember, but yeah, there's another thing. Oh, there was a FOIA request back in the early 90s that someone had put in, and there's this, an old website. You have to go to the Wayback Machine, the web archive, to find this, but someone actually did this FOIA request and found that a lot of these medals probably weren't earned, and there was a quote from a memo that was put out by the there's an officer that investigated his medals. Actually, his quote was that at this time, medals were raining down from the heavens. Basically, you could earn a medal for whatever. They weren't being fact checked at all. So you could
good PR.
Yeah, you could just go ask for a medal and they would give it to you during this time. So, like I said, he's probably a bit of a huckster.
Interesting character, yeah, for sure.
So that's Bo Greitz. I mean,
and he's now in Nevada, you said, or
still
somewhere?
Still living in Nevada, yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, any final thoughts on that one?
I'm wondering if maybe some of them was messed up from the war, you know, but then you talk about the huckster. But, I mean, how much of, even if it was only a couple medals, it's still, you know,
yeah,
impressive.
I'm sure he earned a lot of them. I mean, being a special forces commander, I mean, that's
then
not...
Then why the lot?
Yeah, I mean, maybe he's trying to build himself up more than he really was. I don't know.
My thought is, I think it's an important point that there is a difference between groups like that we're seeing in Charlottesville, you know. I'm not saying they're right. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying there's a difference between what, you know, white, just abject, is straight on white supremacist, like, yeah, Richard Butler is, and some with Bo Greitz, right? I mean, racist tinges perhaps, but, you know, there's also like, this is a definitely anti-Semitic, you know, but also really strongly anti-government. And like, I think there's also an important point is this is another example where the people of North Idaho, there are definitely groups that are not really supporters of the government, but they're not going to go that far. And they see that it's bad for their community to have that. So, you know, there's a lot of nuance in these things that we'd like to be clear and cut, but they are never clear and cut because history's not clear and cut.
So let me add one little layer really quick on this.
Oh, don't mess up my thought on this, man. What are you going
to
say?
So I forgot to add some of my sources on here. Like I talked about the Atlantic article. It's really good. There's a bunch of Time articles. There's a bunch of reporting in the newspapers. Like just go, if you go have newsreaders.com, just type his name and you'll find all the stuff.
Right.
But also like I spent a lot of time on the Southern Poverty Law Center's website, which I don't always love because they do lean very far left on a lot of their reporting. Right. For example, on their website, they have a picture of Almost Heaven and it's just these very crappy looking trailers that they're showing. But there were also multi-million-dollar houses in Almost Heaven. So it's like they're kind of picking and choosing what they want to show to the world.
Right, because they have a larger objective.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it was the same kind of thing with when I was looking into the Aryan Nations. I'm not saying I don't agree with most of what they're saying.
The thing is, like,
there's propaganda for maybe the right, for I know the right reason in many cases.
But they're really the best source, even if they are skewed to the left, right? They really are their best source on hate. I mean, between them and like the Anti-Defamation League, which I also spent some time on, they're good sources, but you know, you gotta use your head on these and evaluate.
Have to go the FBI sources on these things or something.
Right.
Those aren't easy to get into, I doubt.
Some of the stuff's been declassified. Like I found the from Ruby Ridge, it actually has like a timeline of what Bogreitz did at Ruby Ridge.
Oh, okay.
Is it all broken down? Stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, super interesting. Wow. We really jumped on in. We'll do the part three of crazy shit in North Idaho with Ruby Ridge, I guess. Yep. They'll all kind of converge into one big coalesce set.
Yeah, I'm actually excited to get into this one. Like, you know, we talked about, I think in the Aryan Nations one, that we were kind of leading up to Ruby Ridge, and I think that's probably about where we're at now. So get to talking to Tim and we'll see what we can do.
I'll talk to Tim, but I think, well, I already have and he's down, but I think maybe just a little break.
Yeah.
Last week we talked about POWs and there was some convergence today, but you know, that was one of our happier ones.
Yeah. Right. Anyway. So up next, we got the episode. I'm interviewing Maggie Takata Hall about her book, Love in the Library. And then, Mark, we're going to hate to use this term, but we're going to do a deep dive on the Titanic. And the
too soon,
especially with recent events, right? With the passengers that were actually on the Titanic who were headed for Idaho. So I'm actually excited for that one as well, right?
That's very interesting.
So
now I got to find something really crazy to look into.
Yes, you do.
Now you're batting way above par. I don't know. I guess that's a golf term.
Yeah.
Way below par, I guess. Right.
Yeah. All right. I think with that, we'll say see you later.
Good one, Jeff.
Thanks.
Sayonara.
Bye.
If you want to get a hold of us, send an email to info@idahistory.com. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Ida History. You can visit us on the web at idahistory.com. Ida History would like to thank our listeners, sponsors, and contributors. If you want to know how you can become a contributor, go to idahistory.com/podcast. Please consider giving us a rating and review on your podcast app. I'm Tom Hart, and this is Devil's County.